and Sean's the guy to answer them.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's nice to meet you, Sean. I'm humbled and interested to hear kind of where, so what started you on this road? I was reading some of the information that Kara sent me, and interesting, couldn't trace my way back on some of the things that you referenced. And obviously, you had done some research before, but prior to this, in terms of the microbiome and supportive gut, you know, sort of the gut prebiotic and the gut inner membranes and such. I'm wondering what that was about, because the product itself sounds intriguing, but what was it that started it? Like, what is the research that you based this on?
Yeah. That's a good question, actually. So, you know, my background is in nutritional biochemistry. So I'm not like a microbiologist kind of a person who studies gut bacteria as my focus of my work. My work is really looking at what are biochemical changes, things like stress hormones and neurotransmitters and inflammatory markers and things like that. How do those things change human performance? And a big part of human performance is the mental performance side of it. So I've been studying that part, biochemistry driving human performance, whether it's physical performance or psychological performance, for most of my career. The microbiome piece of it is something that got layered in for me about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. I've been working with a laboratory here in Salt Lake City for that long, 5 or 6 years, looking at microbiome patterns as a way to change how people behave. And so that sounds kind of like mad scientist kind of thing. Like, if we can get this, you know, if we can get these bacteria to change someone's behavior, you know, that sounds a little diabolical, but it's from the perspective of, you know, if we can change the signals that are coming from the bacteria, which are the things that make most of our neurotransmitters, 90% of our serotonin, 70% of our dopamine, all that kind of stuff, right? If that's a big piece of what's driving this biochemistry, we should go to that as sort of a core building block amongst everything else that we're doing. And so that's what really got me into it. And what we found with that lab is that we could, you know, we developed a technique to measure microbiome status very, very quickly, very cheaply, very reproducibly. Like, it, you know, up until that, and even now, it's very difficult and very time consuming and very expensive to measure somebody's microbiome. But right. We have a technique that can do it pretty quickly.
How's that? Can I ask about that?
Yeah.
Look, am I losing you? Oh no.
No. Okay. Fine. You just want to know how we do that.
Well, yeah, only because, so here's where I'm going to just interject this small thing. We know.
Oops. Now we can't hear you. Say that again, Laurel.
Hang on. I may have to call back on a different phone. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you could also take yourself off video, Laurel.
Okay. Let me do
that. Yeah, that's what I just did too, to lower the bandwidth.
Okay. Is that better?
Yep. Yeah, great.
Can you hear me, Sean?
Yep. Yep. Okay. Can hear you fine.
All right. So if we know that the microbiome is 30 to 40,000 bacteria, we've got fungi, we've got parasites, we've got viruses. So my question is, knowing that, you know, I've certainly been through, and I'm a microbiologist, I'm an eye doctor, but I'm a microbiologist undergraduate and master's. So how exactly are you sampling that microbiome and identifying, because the flora there is so incredibly diverse?
Yeah, it really is. So we take a fecal sample, right? We take a poop sample from people. Right. And we measure the bacteria. We're not measuring the fungi. We're not measuring any of the other pieces of what makes up the sort of broader microbiome. And the reason for that is that you can measure that stuff, but we don't even know the first thing, to be perfectly honest with you, about what any of that contributes. We know that it's there. We know that it sort of keeps in check some of the bacteria. It probably enhances the activity of some of the other bacteria. So, like, you know, if 90 something percent of the microbiome is that bacterial colony, that's the piece to look at. That's what's doing most of the production of the chemicals that we're most interested in anyway. The other things, I think we'll definitely learn more about them as science progresses. You know, there are people who are focusing specifically on the microbiome, right? The fungal mm-hmm. part of that. And there's people mm-hmm. who are focusing specifically on the virome, the virus part of that, you know? So, you know, that's great. We'll learn more from that, but I don't think we're there where we can actually have any actionable effect on those pieces right now. So.
Right. I would agree. Okay. So given that then, so keep going with, I kind of interjected that. So you found a new, simple or easier way to sample microbiome.
Yeah. So most laboratories will use a technique that's called 16S. They're measuring a little piece of RNA that's associated with different bacterial species. And by measuring that, you can tell what species are there.
Right.
What you can't tell with 16S is down to the level where you really need to get, which is looking at specific strain levels. You can't get that specific with 16S, which isn't the problem with 16S. The big problem with 16S is that it's expensive and it's time consuming and the machines go down all the time and there's a lot of upkeep. We use a PCR technique, a polymerase chain reaction technique, where we're actually looking at just a subset of the overall microbiome. But from our research, we think that that's the subset that really matters, at least right now. It'll change over time as we learn more. But it's sort of like if there's ever sort of pushback on the way that we do it, it's that people are like, you're not looking at enough, right? If there's 10,000 mm-hmm. species and you're only looking mm-hmm. at a few dozen, is mm-hmm. that enough of a look in order to tell what the rest of the microbiome is doing? And it depends on what you're looking for, right? If we're looking for patterns of change, it is enough. If we're trying to analyze the whole darn microbiome, it's not enough, but that's not what we're trying to do. I don't think that that's necessary. It's like, if you're looking for the definition of one word, you don't have to go and read the entire dictionary, right? That's the analogy that I like to use with people. Like we're looking at enough of it to say, huh, here's where somebody is. Here's what happens when we apply this intervention. Here's where they are after the better. And we're not looking at just the microbiome. We're looking at the microbiome pattern change and then how that correlates with other changes like stress hormones and inflammation and mood state and things like that.
And how, and are you actually measuring those things, or are those subjective questionnaires, or what is that?
Yeah, we're measuring all of them. And you know, when we measure mood state, I mean, it is subjective, but we use objective techniques. So there are a lot of very well-validated surveys that can measure depression and anxiety and burnout and things like that. So like it's subjective in the sense that the person is telling you how they feel on a particular parameter, but the data is collected in a way that is a very objective, reproducible look at how they're doing over time.
Okay. All right. And are you measuring any of the hormone levels at that point also? Or are you looking at, you know, cortisol?
Yep. Yeah, so we look at cortisols pretty routinely. We don't look at them in every trial. So some of the trials that we'll do, we'll look at microbiome and mood state. Like, you know, the microbiome changed this direction. What aspect of mood state changed, right? And sometimes we'll see, like, if it changes, you know, if the pattern changes in A direction, depression changes. If it changes in B direction, confusion changes. If it changes in C direction, fatigue changes, right? So we see those sorts of things. What we're trying to do, and we showed this in our last trial, if you can change the microbiome in another certain pattern, you get an overall holistic change where the person's well-being improves. So their depression changes somewhat, their fatigue changes somewhat, their confusion changes somewhat. So I think we'll be to the point sometime where we could say to somebody, look, if you just need to feel generally better, you do this. If you need to feel specifically better in terms of, you know, if we know that it's just the depression piece that needs to change in that person, we would do a different intervention that only, you know, hits that button, so to speak. We're starting to do work in athletes too, to be able to say, look, if you're a runner, long distance runner, maybe we need to change your microbiome in this direction. Whereas if you're a power lifter, a strength athlete, we can need to change your microbiome in that direction. You know, so we're not quite there yet, but we'll get there eventually.
And so,
Anyway, I went down that rabbit hole. I didn't actually answer your question. So sometimes we measure just the microbiome and the mood state. Sometimes we'll measure microbiome, mood state, and then the piece in the middle there, which is what are those actual signals. And so sometimes that's cortisol. Sometimes it's inflammatory markers like cytokines. Sometimes we're looking at different levels of like oxidative load. Are the people more oxidized or less oxidized? Those are some of the sort of intervening signals that we'll look at sometimes.
And when you sample, when you pull in this your cohort, so to speak, to sample, are you establishing baselines? What are you doing to establish a baseline at that point?
Yeah, so the same measurements that we'll look at the end, we'll look at the beginning. So the baselines will be an initial fecal sample, an initial saliva sample, an initial blood sample, an initial mood state survey, depending on what cohort we're looking at. Sometimes, like if we look at depressed people, we'll use a different survey than if we're looking at just stressed out people, we'll use a different survey for that. So they have different sensitivities for what mood you're looking at.
Okay. Any metabolic testing at that point, or?
Yeah, we've done that. We've looked in some of our trials at resting metabolic rates. We've looked at like VO2 maxes. We've looked at those sorts of things. But to be perfectly honest with you, they're so variable test to test and person to person. They're not giving us a lot of information at this point. So. I don't know if that might change as we get better at it, but that's sort of where we are right now.
Right. I guess what I was thinking is more of a CMP, a metabolic panel. So go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, we've looked at things like CRP, like as inflammatory markers, but, not other things.
So my question becomes then how, this is what concerns me. I think there's tremendous application here, and I've read a lot. And how, when you feed a system one thing, it's not only interacting in that system. So you've got rollout or implications in other parts of the pathway. So how do we know that you're upregulating hormones for depression? How do you know you're not creating some kind of upregulation or downregulation in other parts that are involved with the gut? So, because it is so systemic, right? So there's the mental impact, which I get, but then there's the basic physiologic impact. So how are you knowing that these bacteria are so important? And yeah, they're responsible for, as you say, creating so many of the components of our system that operate. How do you know that it's not doing something downstream or upstream along with it? Simple things, stem cells, right? You can do stem cell correction, right? But stem cells go rogue and then they upregulate cancer. So that's way off in left field in terms of an analogy, but that was one of my concerns, is how do we know what else you're doing? Like, you give this to somebody and yeah, they feel better, at least mood wise. Has that been explored at all? Or?
Well, that's one of the reasons that we're measuring so many things besides just microbiome and mood state, right? To try to get a bigger view on, why we're getting the effects that we're getting, what the mechanisms of those effects are. But you can't measure everything, no study is going to be able to measure every single, aspect of.
Yeah, that's part of the difficulty with nutrition, right? Because there are so many variables involved. And the population, just the cohort or the population that you're sampling, assuming you're starting with a healthy cohort, standardized for, I don't know if you standardized age and certain pre-existing conditions, or whether you are saying, let's just take a diverse population and see how it impacts all of them.
Yeah. When we recruit, our exclusion criteria per se are, people can't be taking antidepressants, which sometimes makes it really difficult for us to for us to, you know, get a clean population, right? Sometimes, you know, if we're looking for people with depression, it's hard to find people who have depression but aren't on an antidepressant. And the reason we do that is because it interferes with the sensitivity of the mood state surveys that we use. So, it really depends on the population that you're looking at. And, you know, based on that population, you're looking at completely different kinds of baseline microbiome patterns, right? So, even though we might be applying the same sort of general principles, you know, trying to get people to, you know, quote unquote, more good bacteria and less bad bacteria, that change is going to look, even though the intervention is pretty much the same for across the populations, their individual change is going to be a little bit different than somebody who might be in another bucket, so to speak.
Right. And that's where, so someone who's got autoimmune disease, right, their gut microbiome is probably, could be one of the main factors that's contributing other than epigenetic and genetic predisposition, right?
So, exactly.
So you have someone now that's got autoimmune disease that's feeling depressed. How do you manage that? And would that have been part of your sampling? Because that's a whole different...
Yeah. So the way that we have studied autoimmune system, situations is to look at people with allergies, right? So we can look at people with seasonal allergies or situational allergies, like, you know, allergic to cats or allergic to, you know, pollen or something like that, right? So the same exact thing. And this speaks to, you know, people will sometimes ask me the question like, well, wait a minute, if there's all these different microbiomes out there, how can you apply one supplement regimen is going to help everybody? That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And you say,
right,
well, it actually does make sense when you think of what we're actually trying to do. We're trying to take everybody back to the same sort of general pattern, like I said before, of more good bacteria, less bad bacteria. That is going to be the same for everybody at this point. And I'll explain why in just a second. Someday, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, we'll be able to go in and we'll have enough data where we can say, you know, Laurel, your microbiome looks like this, and Cara's looks like this, and Sean's looks like this. And that's going to be three slightly different interventions because your microbiome is starting in a different place and we know enough about it to really, really customize it. We're not quite there scientifically. But the best we can do right now, you could all benefit from more good bacteria and less bad bacteria. So let's do that. And as a result of that, you're gonna be better in these other ways. So one example of that is that we can take somebody who has allergies, so they have an overactive immune system, and we can have somebody who has a suppressed immune system. So, you know, suppressed by stress or suppressed by sleep deprivation or suppressed by overtraining if we're looking at athletes. And those people, because they have a suppressed immune system, they're catching lots of colds and flus and lots of upper respiratory tract infections and things like that. So you would say, you might look at that and say, well, wait a minute, overactive immune system, underactive immune system, how does that require the same intervention? Because when you intervene at the level of the microbiome, you're allowing the microbiome to re-educate the immune system to pay attention to things better that it should attack, like viruses and bacteria. So their low immune system benefits from that. But you're also telling the microbiome to educate the immune system about what to ignore. So it ignores the pollen and it ignores the cat dander. And so you're taking an overactive immune system down to normal. So that what I just described, we refer to as an immune system priming effect, where it takes high to normal and it takes low to normal. And therefore you get that improvement of performance in the end. And it's the same intervention.
Is that published research? Is that something I could look at?
Yeah, so we've published that for when we do it directly to the immune system, looking at things like yeast extracts and mushroom extracts. So those data are published. We haven't published it coming one level below that from the microbiome. So right now in our product line, in our MRI product line, we do it from both perspectives. We prime the immune system by going directly to the immune system, and we secondarily prime the immune system by focusing on the microbiome, because the microbiome tells the immune system what to do in large part. So we haven't published that last piece of it yet, but we will eventually.
Because I'd be this is where I kind of geek out and I'm really interested in seeing. So, how you are active, you know, it's that, I guess when you talk about the all the components of an allergic response. So I'm intrigued by it. I'm intrigued by the actual data and just seeing like, okay, how I, you know, because my devil's advocate is going to say, oh my gosh, you listen to people like, I don't know if you're familiar with Zach Bush or Peter Attia or Rhonda,
yep.
right? Who sit and talk for hours about the fact that our systems are so specialized. And, you know, Zach recently said, the only way you're going to normalize your flora is by getting your hands in the soil of the area you live in. It is that particular to, and our microbiome is so particular to our culture, our where we've been brought up, or, you know, everything from sort of our birth process to where we normally habitate and the type of food we consume. And, you know, his whole thing is you can't necessarily alter that. You can get your hands in the earth. You can eat local organic vegetables and sort of start to populate and repopulate through that. So that's one question I have is how does that really happen? Other thing is that I've heard is how do you, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to say, I agree with part of that, but not all of that. Right. There are people out there who say, after the age of three, your microbiome is set and you can't really change it. And that's just absolutely wrong. We can pretty dramatically change the structure of your microbiome in 3 days with a dietary change, right? So, you know, I completely reject that. I do agree with the fact that, you know, people do sort of take on the microbiomes of their geographic area. And I mean, that's been shown, but it's also been shown that if somebody moves, right? So somebody moves from Southeast Asia to San Francisco, they start to develop the microbiome of San Francisco. We could talk for hours about that, I guess.
No, but I completely agree with that. I don't think it's stagnant. I do think you're right. It's influenced very much. I didn't know 3 days, but no, I do know. And I've actually done some research and been at N of one or two, where we've gone in and looked at as much microbiome in ourselves as we could. And it's interesting because I'm in healthcare, and to the extent that we're getting this limited slice, right? I was populated with things that are endemic to healthcare workers.
You're right.
And, you know, so it's that specialized and that, and yet very diverse. So I get that. I really do.
There's another layer of it too that I think it's just starting to catch on with a lot of people, which is there's the structural aspect of your microbiome, right? Which is, you know, what's growing there, what bacteria are there, what fungus is there, you know, all that kind of stuff. But then there's the functional side of it too, right? Of, you know, that same, like, you know, let's say that you and I had the exact same, which would never happen, but just for the sake of argument, we had two people with the same exact structure of microbiome, the same number of species, the same number of strains, the same diversity, all that kind of stuff. Those two microbiomes could be very functionally different in terms of what they're producing. And so that aspect of it is like, you know, you can, your intervention to a given good or bad microbiome could change it functionally so that it's producing different chemicals that are having a different end effect in that person. You know, so that's another layer that I think a lot of people don't have a good appreciation for, you know?
Yeah. And I completely agree and understand that. That's why I think, oh my gosh. So in a sense, I don't know how to ask this. Let me step back because I think we're in agreement in all of it. I'm just wondering sort of how you drill down to say, okay, I think it was a couple of specific bacteria that I was seeing that you cited. It's just one thing that Kara sent me. More of the common ones, but actually I was going to say, no, they weren't. But how did you land on that, knowing exactly what you just said, which is, you've got different downstream outcome with same bacteria. I'm not probably phrasing this as well as I'd like.
No. I know exactly what you're asking. So, you know, people ask that question a lot. Like, you know, why did you choose these three bacteria, right? If they're looking at, so our flagship product Fundamentals is our gut brain axis system. And one of the products in that kit is called Mentabiotics. And in that powder, there are three probiotic bacteria. People ask the question all the time. They're like, well, How do you know that I'm this individual need those three? You know, what if my level of those three is fine and I don't need to supplement with them? Or, you know, a related question would be, why do you choose those three and not any three others that you could have chosen? Right. So we chose those three because they've already been clinically validated in human trials to change mood state. So you can take, you know, one of them is sort of, you know, each one is there for a different reason. One is the anti-depression bacteria. One is an anti-stress bacteria. One is an anti-anxiety. Based on the trials that were done, you know, one trial implemented this one and people had an anti-depression effect, you know, et cetera. So that's one reason that we looked at those three to begin with. The other reasons had to do with things like, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you about access to that research, but keep going.
Yeah, so that research, we have a document called a technical data sheet that's on the page for this particular product, Mentabiotics, that has all the scientific abstracts that step you through all of those. You know, here's the Helvetica's 52 data, here's the Bifidolongum 175 mm-hmm. paper, you know, all that kind of stuff. So people who want to dig into that, that's available to you.
Yeah, Laurel, I think I sent that to you. It's in the Fundamentals technical paper.
Yeah, I saw at the bottom, there were a couple of citations that didn't seem, I'll look at it again, but I saw three citations that I started to reference and I didn't, but yeah, I'm just curious in the source of that.
So the other reason we chose those three, there might be a dozen specific strains of bacteria that have a very nice mood state effect in humans that have been well documented, right? But the reason mm-hmm. we chose these three and not those other, you know, nine or whatever are out there is because these three also have really good shelf life. They don't have to be, you know, delivered in any particular way. We can put them in a powder and they survive the stomach acid. And, you know, so there's sort of some development reasons that we use these three mm-hmm. instead of some other three. So anyway, where was I going with this? Oh, so you know, then the question becomes, if we give those to people, can we measure them in the microbiome later on? And this is something I hardly ever say to anybody because nobody cares to ask this question. And the answer is no, we do not see them in the microbiome after we supplement them. And you know, people are like, what? Wait a minute, I take them and they don't stay in my microbiome? That means they're useless. And we say, no, it doesn't mean they're useless. They're actually very useful because we can measure this mood state change in people. But the fact that they're not taking up residence is telling us that they're transient. We give them to you. We know we gave them to you. We know that they're arriving in your gut. And we know that they're having a mood state effect. But they're just changing the metabolism of somebody else that already is resident there, right? So that's what I was kind of referring to before, is that people, I think, sometimes think, I'm going to take this and it's going to grow in my gut. And should I take more or less? And if I take too much, will it grow too much? And, you know, all that kind of stuff. But sometimes it doesn't even matter because a lot of these supplemental probiotics never, ever take up residence. And it's, you know, it's not just these three. There's evidence for this for lots and lots of other ones too. But that doesn't make them ineffective. It just means that they're having their effect in other ways.
So they're acting as a cofactor in a sense.
Yeah. They may be changing the metabolism of another bacteria that is resident in the gut. Mm-hmm. It may be suppressing the activity of another bacteria that's in the gut. It might be, you know, some of these immune system effects are happening because, you know, most of, you know, 70% or so of your immune tissue is resident in the gut and it has its signaling effects throughout the whole body. So it might be affecting part of the immune system, which is having a signaling effect on your adrenal glands or something like that. So like, you know, sometimes the more I talk, the more it's evident that there's a lot we don't know what's going on, but we're also very honest about that, that like, these are early days, right? And we're a startup and we're trying to figure this out along with all the academic institutions, you know? So that's what makes it fun.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be interesting looking back to see what we thought we knew, which we didn't, you know?
And right.
I think personalized medicine in the area of getting into so much of the study we're at the front edge.
And I say, let me say one thing about that, Laurel. I tell people all the time, like, you know, 10 years from now, you know, a lot of times people come to an Amari meeting and it's the first time they've ever heard about the microbiome, right? And it sounds like science fiction. And I'll say to them, I'm like, listen, 10 years from now, you won't leave your annual physical without getting a microbiome analysis. Like, it's going to be as routine as your blood pressure, your heart rate, and your cholesterol test. And it's going to be telling us a whole heck of a lot more about what your future health looks like, you know? So it's coming. Right. Get ready for it.
Right. Yeah, no, I think epigenetically it'll be another application there.
For sure.
But yeah. So, all right. So then what's the other, in terms of the other question I had said, and I'm jumping around a little bit, is the delivery system. I know you talked about I'm not looking at the research, but it was essentially your prebiotic. Was it a GABA, globulin, something?
Galacto-oligosaccharide, you might be thinking of.
That's what it was.
Yeah. So we've got in our Mentabiotics product, we have three different prebiotics. One's a GOS, a galacto-oligosaccharide. One is a galactomannan, and one is an IMO, an isomaltooligosaccharide. And so each fiber structure will feed a different bacteria.
Okay.
Just one. And the just so happen feed the three fibers that we give. So we make that match up so that we get, you know, good growth efficiency.
So is that helping to improve the lining, or that's just facilitating the process with the bacteria?
It's a little of both. In our trial, we were able to see an improvement in gut lining. Is that coming from the prebiotics, or is it coming from the probiotics, or is it becoming, or is it happening because of, you know, because we're changing the environment of the gut and the, you know, there's less inflammation there. I think it's a little bit of all of that.
Okay. You're cutting. I'm losing you. It may be me.
Can you hear me now?
That last sentence I didn't hear at all. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So one of the really cool sort of side benefits that people are getting is they're getting better gut integrity. You know, so they're, you know, we're able to show them that the microbiome is more diverse. We're able to show them that their mood state is better. But one of the bacteria strains that we look at is the strain called Akkermansia, which lives in the mucus lining of your gut. And so we have people we're able to show them at the beginning, you know, you're non-detectable. You don't even have any Acker that we can see. That means you have low mucus. That means you probably have leaky gut. And it certainly means you have an inflamed gut. And over the course of supplementation, we can show them after about 2 weeks, now it's detectable, this Akkermansia. And then after 4 weeks, it's abundant. And so that's telling us several things all at the same time by measuring that one bacteria.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, and this was really broad scale. When you talk about this, how broad was the study? I noticed the one that was published was 32 participants.
Yeah, so, and those were all specifically recruited to be what we call healthy stressed. So, you know, they didn't have antidepressants like I talked about before. Mm-hmm. They had moderate levels of psychological stress. They were either sleep deprived or self-reported on a screener scale that we use, you know, that they weren't just, you know, calm cucumber kind of people, right? That they, you know, they were busy kind of people. You know, some of them were first responders and they had a lot going on in their lives and things like that. So, you know, the question with that is that, you know, would we see the same effect in people who were worse off? Would we affect people who had major depressive disorder or anxiety disorders or something like that? And I think we would, because the individual ingredients in the product have already been studied in those populations. And so, like, you know, the reason we studied healthy stress in that cohort is because, you know, I didn't want to repeat looking at another population of depressed people. Like, that's already well-trodden ground. We wanted to look and see, like, hey, is this going to work for, like, regular people, you know, who wouldn't say they have any problems, you know?
Right. Okay. So with the study that you were talking about previously with the ACRO, are those were your studies or are those, and if so, was it the same kind of structure, meaning 30 or 40 patients in the cohort and split placebo versus not?
Exactly. Those are always the kinds of studies that my group does. You know, we're always looking at 30, 40, 50, 60 subjects. And, you know, if we're doing it, if we're designing a study the right way and we have an intervention that actually works, if you can get statistical significance at 30 subjects, then you know you have a really good, you know, real effect, like a robust effect. One of the reasons, you know, people look at that sometimes and go, oh, 30 subjects, you know, these pharmaceutical studies have 1,000 subjects, you know? And the reason for that is that, you know, you need 1,000 subjects if you have a small effect in order to sort of tease that out in your statistics.
Right.
And you need even more. Some people respond positively and some people respond negatively. You know, at least, you know, often with these lifestyle interventions, almost everybody responds in the direction that you're hoping they will. You know, they're getting better because, you know, you're, you know, along with the positive thing you're adding, you're telling them to eat less processed foods or something like that, you know? So you're, you know, in a sense, and this is going to sound wrong, you know, in a sense, you're like the deck is stacked in your favor because you're trying to get people to a healthier lifestyle anyway. So you're going to see something. It's just a matter of, do you see something above and beyond the placebo, you know, situation?
Exactly. And so with the placebo, would you be telling them, so everything's the same, right? It's just they're getting a whatever supplement that's a sugar pill or something or anything else.
Yep, exactly. Okay. In our case, it's usually cornstarch or something like that, right? So they get the same exact thing. And we're really like one of the reasons that we like, you know, that our group is, you know, pre-Amare, I ran a product development company and we would do research for lots and lots of different nutrition companies. And, you know, we would say, look, one of the reasons that you want to hire us is because we get really, really good compliance with whatever the intervention is. Like we're calling our subjects, you know, every week, we're emailing them every day. We're making sure they take their stuff. We're making sure that they don't do other things. Like a lot of times you'll see people come in these trials and they're like, yeah, I'm in this health trial. I'm going to eat a perfect vegan diet now. And I'm not going to eat any fast food. And I'm going to, you know, go to bed at 9 o'clock every night. And like they change their whole lifestyle compared to what they were doing before. And it completely throws everything out of whack, you know? So you really have to make sure that they're doing what you want them to do so that the only change is that intervention that you're doing.
Okay. So you are holding that standard.
Yep.
And, okay. Well, I guess, you know,
because I feel like I've been in a graduate level science.
I know this is like PhD.
Holy crap. Like taking notes, like crazy.
Oh, wow. You know, I'd be the same way on the other side of your world, Kara. But it, you know, it's just, it really, Sean, it's a world that I'm fascinated by, obviously. Because of, and I'm not actively in it at this point. It was more, you know, undergraduate, graduate. Now I look at eyeballs, but I am clearly, you know, in my day-to-day practice with patients, there are five things that I ask patients that probably are not part of a standard eye exam, which is what are you eating? How are you sleeping? What kind of exercise do you have? You know, how's your general relationship with your partner, and also what about alcohol and drugs, right?
That's so awesome. Yep.
And it is phenomenal. And you know, I talked to Kara, the application, there is no question that I'm in a pretty healthy environment, you know, where I would say socioeconomic class where I am is pretty outstanding. And yet these people don't sleep, don't eat well, don't exercise, and have all kinds of issues. And so I do address this, and so part of what I was looking at is, so is this something that I could apply in my population? But again, it is the diversity of who I see. I mean, I guess we go everything from rural farm workers to Duke and UNC academic research triangle tech personalities. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's to me, I'm trying to wrap my head around, would it be something that would apply given the huge variance?
Yeah. Let me tell you how I explain that to people is that, you know, whenever I give a presentation, I talk about what I refer to as a mental wellness continuum. So it goes from 1 to 10, you know, it looks like a, you know, rainbow spectrum. And you've got people on the low side who are depressed, anxious, burned out. You've got people in the middle who are just, you know, like the people I described before that, you know, they feel fine, but they don't have any real problems. They might have some stress. They might have some tension. They might have some restlessness, that kind of stuff in the middle. And then you've got people at the far end, you know, the optimized side that are, you know, they're athletes or they're professionals or they're just like they're killing it every single day and they're doing great. And mm-hmm. each of those buckets, so to speak, can benefit from everything that we just talked about. The same sort of a microbiome repatterning, more good guys, less bad guys. The same idea of lowering inflammation and improving brain blood flow and priming your immune system, all that kind of stuff. Those principles are going to apply at each of those buckets, but they're going to be getting different set of benefits, so to speak. The people at the low end are going to start to feel normal again. The people who are in the middle are going to start to feel better than they've ever felt. And the people at the high end are going to be able to get that little bit of a competitive edge that maybe was eluding them before, right? So it's all sort of the same things that we're applying, but wherever mm-hmm. you're starting, you're getting a different collection of benefits that's meaningful for you.
But again, we don't know if they have pre-existing sort of, and again, I know you're stressing on the mood end. I'm just thinking, okay, so hypertensive, diabetic, endocrine issues, and what did I leave out? Autoimmune. So is that something you would refrain from recommending?
No, not at all. And in fact, those people can benefit even more than average. So one of the reasons we focus on the mental part of it is because we can uh-huh. deliver that very easily, very readily. People notice these things are working sometimes the day they take them, certainly the week they take them, and almost without fail the month that they take them. People are like, oh my gosh, I feel better. And then they'll fill in the blank of how they feel better. And the reason we focus on that is that if we can get someone to feel better relatively quickly like that, they're going to mm-hmm. keep taking it. They're going to take it the next week. They're going to take it the next month. And then what we end up seeing, and we don't have data for this for a very important reason I'll explain to you in a second, but we don't have data for the physical health benefits that we're seeing. But we've been selling products now for almost 2 years, and we have these near miraculous physical health changes. You know, pain is going away, tissues are healing, people are getting off of their, you know, their diabetes medication, they're off of their blood pressure medication, skin tone is changing. I mean, things where, like, a lot of my colleagues at the company were like, in the first 6 months, they're like, what is going on? Why are we hearing these have nothing to do with mental health. And I said, well, actually they do, because the same things that are changing biochemically that lead us to these mental wellness changes, things like inflammatory level, things like oxidative level, things like hormone balance, those are all related to tissue healing and the ability of the body to heal itself once it's in the right balanced state. So, you know, we give them the mental wellness benefits early, and it's almost like a Trojan horse of making them feel better quickly so that they can get physically better after, you know, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, depending on what sort of ailment they have. And so, you know, when I explain that to people, you know, the next question is, well, how come you don't study that stuff? One reason we don't is because the FDA tells us very specifically to not. FDA has a very strong position on dietary supplements that if I were going to go and do a anti-diabetes study, for example, right? And even if I just did it for our own research and published it and put it in a drawer somewhere and it never became part of our marketing material, the FDA's position on that would be that would be what they would call an implied disease claim. That even though I'm not saying it in my marketing, the fact that I did the research and it's out there would be akin to the company saying that this product treats diabetes. And that's something that supplements aren't allowed to do. So there's a really red line from the FDA that they don't want to do that work. And so that's why we have to do these other, you know, lifestyle things. And it sounds like we're playing with words and, you know, dancing around the issue, but we have to, you know, and in one of the trials we just did, we measured blood sugar control, and we showed that the people who were on the fundamentals had better blood sugar control than after supplementation than before. And so we're going to have to be careful about how we talk about that, and how we present it and things like that, so that we stay really clear of anything that speaks of diabetes.
How are you documenting the blood sugar control with a CGM or with A1C? I mean,
we just did very simple total blood glucose numbers before and after supplementation. We had all the subjects come in fasting state in the morning. We took their blood samples. We measured their blood sugar. You know, so we weren't looking long term. It was either 6 or 8 week intervention. So it was kind of too short to look at. Glycosylated hemoglobins and those sorts of things.
Or even, you know, a continuous glucose monitor. It's really just, some of the research that they're looking at now and sleep and CGMs and sort of all the, and I realized you start to get into the minutiae of things, but it's fascinating to me. I mean, we know so little about blood sugar. As
right, now, exactly.
Right? A1Cs yep. are not a valid measure. We know a 2-hour postprandial or CGM is really the only way you can even start to know. So, yeah, I mean, and I realized that there's limitations to how much you can drill down. I was just asking, you know, okay, what was your metric? And that's what I kept asking Kara. So what metric did they use to document? Right? And I realized you can't pin it down. All right. So then I have a completely different question that isn't looking so much at physiology and metabolism and processing and mood, is sourcing of your nutrients, of what you're, so you've got your bacteria and then you're obviously delivering other products with it.
Uh-oh, I might have lost you.
Hey, Laurel, can you repeat that? And Sean, are you okay on time? I don't want to...
Yeah, I'm fine. I lost Laurel.
Donuts with the...
Go ahead and repeat that.
All right. Sounds like you're back.
So other than the microbiome, in terms of the products that you're delivering, the other nutrients that you're adding to it or the other factors, how are you sourcing them?
Yeah, well we source our ingredients from literally around the globe. I think we source from every continent except for Antarctica. And the reason for that is that some of these things just grow in certain parts of the world. You know, we can't source everything from the U.S., we do all our manufacturing in the U.S., right? So all our finished products are made in the U.S., but our ingredients come from around the globe. So the way that we make sure that we've got good quality ingredients is that we don't just source through generic brokers. We actually have relationships with each of the raw material suppliers so that we can say to them, you know, okay, we want this particular raw ingredient. We want it to be extracted in this particular way. It's typically one that we've chosen because there's some research on it, you know, so that, you know, we'll go to that company that's done the research, and they generally will have a pretty good quality control process in place about how they grow, how they harvest, you know, no pesticides, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they'll give us their certificate of analysis, but then we send all of those raw materials out to third parties to verify what we're being told, you know? So it's sort of like, we trust these people. We've gone into partnership with people that we trust, but then we verify on our own just to make sure that they got it right.
Got it.
And then, you know, we do that at the level of the raw materials, so much so that like I've traveled all around the world to actually see the plants, see where they're grown, stand in the fields. Sometimes I'll do clippings of my own and bring them back to, you know, to do DNA analysis on them and things like that. We analyze for pesticides, we analyze for heavy metals, we analyze for pathogens, we analyze for bioactives. We do all that kind of stuff at the ingredient level, but then we do it again during manufacturing. You know, so we'll have people at the manufacturing line pulling products off, analyzing those, and then we do it again at the end of manufacturing just to confirm, like, we know what we're putting in, but we also want to make sure there's no contamination along the line. And that's actually more common than you would think, that, you know, a manufacturer doesn't clean out their, you know, their encapsulator machinery and, you know, you right. get a contaminant from somebody else's product or something like that, you know? So we don't want to go through that. So we make sure that we look for it.
Well, and that's exactly, I mean, there's so many, if you read any number of analysis of supplements, one is the purity of what they're bringing to it. And two is it standardized to the quantity? So yep. and that's exactly what I was assessing. And so it sounds like purity is something that you're attentive to. And then the standardization is also, I mean, if you wanted to speak to that, and that's really my last question.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, standardization is that it is probably even more important than any of the other stuff that I just said, right? So that, you know, what I was just talking about was, you know, we're looking for making sure that we don't have things that we don't want in there, but then we also want to have, you know, purity, but we want to have effectiveness. So we have to make sure that we have the standardization level. So we have the right bioactives in the particular extracts that we're, you know, and that's why we partner with the specific ingredients. So like we can say, okay, we want to put pine bark in this particular product. There's half a dozen, well, there's probably two dozen different pine barks you can get out there. I'm absolutely not going to buy any of the Chinese material because it's right. contaminated with beetles and lead and all kinds of terrible right. stuff. So that's off exactly. the calendar. And then there's three or four that I would consider. There's one that grows that's from New Zealand. There's one that's from France. There's one that's from Finland. And there's one from someplace else. I can't think of where it is right now, but of those first three, the Finnish material is really good. The French material is so-so because it has good bioactives, but the way they extract it, you get residual solvents in the final extract. And that's something that I've just said at the company, like we're not going to do that. And we ended up using the New Zealand material because it's hot water extracted. So there's no residue whatsoever. So you get good quality bioactives, you get none of the, you know, contaminants that you don't want, and you don't have to worry about potential for solvent residues, you know? So it's like, it's those kinds of things where most people would not think, they'd be like, oh yeah, pine bark, great. But there's a mm-hmm. lot behind the, you know, which pine bark that you have to put right. into your capsule. So.
Absolutely. And you know, that's so good to hear that you're attentive to that. That is clearly a big concern we have. And, knowing the population I'm in, they're going to be demanding that kind of information.
Right, exactly.
Yep. So, you know, it is an academic. So, well, that was really, I mean, there are many things that I can probably, as I look at it, would have spin-off questions. But those are really the sort of initial ones that I had for Kara. And I appreciate your time and your attention to the detail.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was a good conversation. I'd be have this.
Okay. Ah, I just lost you.
Did we lose Sean? Sean, he's still on.
No. Oh, there he is. I'm
okay.
still here.
Well, thank you. So All grateful right. for your time. Really.
All right. Likewise.
Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you both so much.
Yeah, sure and thing. We'll be in touch.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you both. Thanks, Sean. Thanks.
Thank Laura. You. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, guys.
All right. Thanks. Bye.